welcome to this LSC Ideas event. We're here to discuss the reassessing China's economy in uncertain times. I'm Professor Jeffrey Schwerath. I'll be chairing this evening's event. I'm joined by Hannah Bretherton, Professor Ken Denning, and James Miles. The background for this event is one in which we are thinking about potential for a recession in China. And over time, we've sort of refined this event to think less about that direct immediate prospect and more about the sort of way that China can potentially manage growing uncertainty in the world economy. We know that China is now facing a slowdown in its economy, even if it will avoid a recession, at least in the immediate time period, at a time of rising uncertainty and new challenges. Just listing a couple of these off in terms of thinking about this, we know, of course, many of us are focused on events in Hong Kong and what that means not only for the political situation, but also for China's economic development and the role of the RMB in the international monetary system. Those of us focusing on finance will think about it in terms of China's problems in its financial system, and particularly the rapid and sustained buildup of debt concentrated particularly in poorly performing state-owned enterprises and increasingly in riskier small and medium-sized regional banks, some of whom have had to be rescued or bailed out in the last several months. We also know that China increasingly struggles to rebalance its economy from its incredibly successful model based on exports and investment towards a more service and consumption-based model. And of course, in the background of all this is increasing tensions with respect to trade, technology, and other issues, not only with the United States, but with the West more broadly. And increasingly as well, we see China is facing issues with respect to inflation, among other things. I'm fortunate to be part of this excellent panel that we've convened to discuss these issues and a range of other things. We're going to start this evening, moving from my left down the line, with Professor Kent Deng.
Okay. Right. China has been a sort of a miracle since Deng Xiaoping's reforms. After 30, 40 years, China transformed itself. Now, China has problems. A, the growth model. People think China's growth model is actually new. In fact, if you know Chinese history in the past 100 to 120 years, Deng Xiaoping's reform should be regarded as the second westernization movement. In the late 19th century, China had the first westernization movement, which has been long forgotten. In that movement, China opened its door for foreign direct investment, for foreign technology transfer. By the end of that movement, which marked the beginning of the Republican period in the early 1910s, China's total mileage of railways and the total length of China's telegraphs equaled India. So China wasn't backward. Now, the second round of westernization movement started from roughly 1980. When Deng Xiaoping took the political power second time in his career. Now, he made it very clear that China was too poor, so let's make China wealthy again. So for him, whatever works for China, no matter the color of the cat, should be okay. So he's not very ideological. So that's the reason why China all of a sudden opened its doors and basically dismantled all the anti-market regulations and state control. So how many regulations were on the knife? We know about 600 such regulations. So this is an enormous push for China to be part of the international community. Now, currently, China facing a lot of challenges, both internally and externally. you know, apart from China's glorious outlook of, for example, One Belt, One Road future, problems start to emerge from within. Typically, China's unbalanced economy, domestically speaking. We know the housing market has been overheating for a good part of 20 years. So if you lump China's four major cities, Beijing, Guangzhou, Shanghai, and Shenzhen together, you combine up the entire housing on offer in the United States. Yeah. So if you lump all the Chinese city properties together, you can buy up the entire G7 properties in the world. So that shouldn't be right. China is, you know, in terms of total GDP, it's only 2/3 of the U.S. Capacity. How come you can actually swap four cities' properties with the entire U.S. housing market? So something is going on. Something internally is not right in China. So this is really the problem, as I can understand from within. Secondly, Jeff mentioned banking problem. China's banking sector has been exclusively state-owned, and we know that they have this practice. If you have bad debts with the Chinese banks, the banks simply convert your debts to shares. But the problem is you can't cash in the shares because the shares are all dead. Yeah, they're bad debts, just converted to shares, nominal shares. How much will be that, the weight of the shares, that bad debt shares? People say it's about 20 to 30% of total banking assets. So that's enormous. This is a time bomb. It will go off at some point, I'm certain. Yeah. So the U.S. sort of pledge or appeal for China to open up the financial sector, it's a good wishful thinking, because I don't think if they understand the scale and the scope of the Chinese bad debts, they will get in. Yeah, this is really a minefield. So basically, I think the Chinese banking sector is on its way to self-destruction. Yeah, so without a doubt, this has nothing to do with China's trade war with the U.S. or whatever. So this is an entirely internal problem. The next one, tell me when to stop. Yeah. The next one is aging population. Yeah. People say China will become old before becoming wealthy. So at the moment, China's average age really passed the threshold of what we call the middle income trap. So if you are young as a nation, you can easily overcome the middle income trap. But if you're already old before you overcome the trap, you may never actually overcome that trap. So this is the problem facing internally by China. We know the leadership decided to relax one child policy 2-3 years ago. Then there was a boom of babies. In 2 years, in the following 2 years, so the record amount of babies born was 2018, the number was 17 million. This is barely enough to replace China's annual death. This year, until now, the newborn number was only 10 million. So we have 7 million missing. So if this trend continues, China's total population will not only become old, but also become smaller. So this is a problem. Who will actually support the pensioners in China? If no one supports the pensioners, we are facing a social collapse. The society may actually stop functioning. The next one is inequality. So we all know China used to be very equal, certainly as equal as the tigers. So when Deng Xiaoping started China's second westernization movement in the 80s, China's Gini coefficient was about 0.35, so which is really among the most equal societies in the world. Now China is the least equal society in the world. We have various estimates because this is basically, so to speak, a national secret. You can't possibly tell. But the best guess is China's Gini coefficient at the moment is 0.6. Someone said it's close to 0.7. If it is 0.7, this is world record. How can you actually sustain social tranquility by having this enormous gap between the haves and have-nots? So this is, again, an internal problem. So the challenge for me, to sum up, is not external. It is actually internal. So the leadership certainly tells the Chinese population, calm down, trust us, everything will be okay. But as far as we can tell, the slowing down is inevitable. Inequality hasn't been corrected. Bad debts are still there. So whether we have the sort of a war-to-war, trade war with the U.S., or whatever sanctions the G7 country decide to impose on China, say 5G technology, China will actually have to deal with its internal problem the next 10 years. Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll now hear from James Miles, who's the Economist China editor.
Thank you. Well, I want to put some of this in a political context. And first look at the very near term in China. Next year, 2020, a year that should be one of great good cheer in China. Next year is the one in which China should achieve its target of a moderately prosperous society in all respects. It's not a great-sounding goal. Anyone who's been to China will know that it, in many ways, resembles, or at least its biggest cities, resemble those of rich world ones. But this is a goal that has been on the minds of Chinese leaders going back to the time of Deng Xiaoping and has been refined constantly since then, the latest targets being to double GDP of 2010 by 2020, to double average disposable incomes by 2020 compared with 2010, and crucially to eliminate poverty by 2020. Now, somehow, all of these targets, I think, could be achieved. Yes, the economy is slowing, but by the end of next year, I think, with a little bit of revision of GDP statistics, which has been going on recently, it is possible that despite slower growth, China's GDP by the end of next year will be double that of 2010. As for the disposable incomes target, that's already been achieved. Elimination of poverty. There are, or were at the end of last year, 17 or more million people, according to China's definition, in poverty. They've been bringing people out of poverty at a rate of around 12 million a year. So by the end of 2020, it's quite possible that we will see, by China's definition, that problem resolved. Not dwelling too long on the fact that by other definitions, upper middle income international poverty lines set by such international bodies as the World Bank, there will in fact be well over 300 million people living in poverty on the $5.50 a day line. So at least a qualified cheer for China in 2020, and a cheer that will be welcome to the party, given that it's building up now with the first of its centennial goals, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party, which will occur in July of 2021. As Kent has just described, it's going to get an awful lot trickier. Rapid aging, as has just been mentioned, the build-up of debt, and the China-US trade war, which is almost certain to rumble on into the year and quite likely beyond it. The direct and indirect effect of that war, according to the IMF, could be to shave 2 percentage points off GDP growth in 2020. So it may seem that the Chinese dream that Xi Jinping set out to achieve when he took over in 2012 is in trouble. And if it is, what does this mean for Xi Jinping himself? And what does it mean for the economic reforms that he set out to achieve not long after he took over at the third plenum of the 18th Central Committee in 2013? Appeared to commit China, notwithstanding the usual rhetoric about the role of state-owned enterprises, to a strong program of economic reform and one in which market forces would play a decisive role. Not even Deng Xiaoping had gone as far as saying that. But that kind of rhetoric, I think, should be taken with a pinch of salt. We've seen in the past how economic problems, as they build up, can lead to political ones in China. We've heard about the economic problems that China is now facing, and it is reasonable to ask ourselves whether political ones will now compound those difficulties. Think of going back to the Mao era, the aftermath of the Great Leap Forward, the debate that took place then, the rise of pragmatists who said it had all gone too far, the backlash that ensued during the Cultural Revolution, the chaos and mayhem that resulted from that, resulting ultimately in China's becoming a near basket case economy. Think of the debates of the 1980s, which raged throughout that decade between reformers and conservatives over economic reforms. The splits that resulted in the party as a result of that. In 1989, the unrest that we saw nationwide ensuing from this split. Where are we now? The question of economic reform has been pushed to the fore in China's political consciousness as a result of the trade war. Clearly, Trump's objective is to achieve a more balanced a pattern of trade, of bilateral trade, but a major objective of those around him is to bring about systemic change in China, in the economic realm. And that's also still an objective of economic liberals in China, who think reform is essential if some of the problems that have just been described are to be mitigated. In other words, it's the nature of China's economy right now that is a big part of the problem and the huge role of the state in it. We don't, however, see obvious signs of political tension arising from this. We know that the coming years will be tough ones for Xi Jinping. There are other massive issues which will be weighing on his mind right now, from Hong Kong to Taiwan, with its elections coming up in January, Xinjiang, and the international backlash over that. Xi Jinping himself has spoken earlier this year of black swans, grey rhinos, which represent the threats that China could face. And indeed, there are many such creatures around. But do they pose a real threat to political stability? We need to be honest, I think, in assessing this. Our ability to read the tea leaves of Chinese politics is far more limited than it was in the 1980s during the struggles around economic reform at that time. In the 1980s, those struggles were played out to a considerable extent in the open through the pages of official media in the speeches of party leaders. Post Tiananmen, the party has become much better at keeping elite struggles under wraps. Think of the recent tension that occurred during the build-up to Xi Jinping's accession in 2012, the tension surrounding Bo Xilai in Chongqing. We had an impression, certainly, of the rise of Bo Xilai, a new populist leader, a new kind of force in Chinese politics. But we had no idea, really, about what has since, at least, been revealed by the party to have been a plot to take over the leadership of the party, involving Zhou Yongkang, Ling Jihua, Xu Caiho, Guo Boxiong, Sun Jiangcai, a whole array of the glitterati of Chinese politics, who were said to have been involved effectively in plotting a coup. If we are to look for signs of political tension right now, it is absolutely to the highest levels of leadership that we should be looking. If unrest is to take place of the kind that occurred in the late 1980s, it would have to begin, surely, with splits at the top. That was the case in 1989. The Tiananmen protests were preceded by divisions within the elite. So that's where we should be looking. But we don't see any clear signs right now. Occasional snippets, perhaps, the odd rumbling from some members of the princeling group, the leaking perhaps recently of Xinjiang-related documents might be a sign of discontent somewhere in the system. We have no idea, really. It doesn't add up to very much. We can certainly see that support for Xi Jinping is not universal, and talk to intellectuals in China, liberals who've been involved with the ebb and flow of economic policy making over the past 30, 40 years, are a deeply depressed lot. They grumble about Xi. And we can only imagine how much officials caught up in the anti-corruption campaign, military officials whose jobs have been lost over the past few years of Xi Jinping's downsizing the PLA. All these people may well have very good reason to grumble. The fact that we're not hearing anything could be a sign that Xi Jinping's strength is total, so overwhelming that policy debates that normally royal Chinese politics are just not taking place, people keeping their counsel to themselves. I think the next couple of years will test whether it really is the case that Xi has achieved this degree of control. We're coming up now to the Party Congress, the 20th Party Congress in 2022. Normally, preparations for such a big event, this is a 10-yearly Congress, they take place every 5 years, of course, but this one would normally receive more attention. Preparations for that will start getting underway in earnest next year, and normally such an event would involve huge changes in the leadership, including that of the General Secretary, followed in 2023 by the presidency. But of course, Xi Jinping early last year effectively declared himself president for life, and that raised questions about whether there would be a succession at all. So we will be looking for signs that some people will be questioning whether Xi Jinping is the right man to continue working in that job after 2022. And remember again Tiananmen, it involved a struggle for power among people who thought at that time that Deng Xiaoping was a strong man and paramount leader for life. The fact that you have a paramount leader for life in position doesn't mean to say that struggles can't occur. So I think the next couple of years will be very important indeed. But at the same time, we should also remember 2012 and what it was that produced Xi Jinping and Xi-ism in the first place. There's a huge difference between now and 1989. And I think what we have to do is remember the landscape of China as Xi Jinping would have perceived it when he took over. A country in which a national discourse had just opened up, really in the previous, mainly in the previous 3 or 4 years as a result of the spread of WeChat and other social media tools, an enabler to an enormous extent of a national discourse that we hadn't seen before. The emergence in the previous decade of a whole new middle class, and at the same time of another enormous group of migrants who had moved into cities to work. A growing rich-poor gap has been described, and of course rampant corruption and a vicious power struggle in the months preceding Xi's accession to power. In other words, from the party's point of view, a terrifying landscape. And within weeks of Xi taking over, we saw protests on the streets of Guangzhou calling for a multi-party system outside the newspaper Nanfang Zhoumo. That is why I think his rule has been so utterly focused on control. And it's why I think it will absolutely remain so. From his perspective, questions about economic reform are really questions about political control, keeping state-owned enterprises in a dominant position in the economy is also about keeping the party firmly in power. As he surveys a country with most of job growth coming from the private sector, with huge new non-state businesses coming to the fore in the Chinese economy, what he sees is a potential political threat arising from this new empowered entrepreneurial class, hence the party committees in every private enterprise, hence the controls. He's well aware, I think, of the economic risks ahead. He's well aware on the drags on the economy, of debt, and all that might arise from that, the horrors in the financial system that have just been described. But the way to deal with that is not reform, I think, from his perspective. It's to ensure that the party has the ability to control any outbreak of unrest at the grassroots that that might pose a challenge. And what will replace those goals that will have been achieved next year, the moderately prosperous society ones? Well, in 2035, China's supposed to become a modern country, according to Xi Jinping, a modern PLA by then, a global leader in innovation. But there won't be numbers attached to this. There won't be redoublings of GDP and income and so on and so on. Nationalism, I think, is likely to surpass economic growth as a source of the party's legitimacy. And I fear that doesn't augur particularly well.
Great. Thanks a lot, James. And now we'll hear from... We'll hear from Hannah Retherton. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, I guess after hearing from Kent and James on their internal sort of struggles China's facing, my role on the panel today is to situate that within the context of broader uncertain times, as the title suggests. So we can't divorce the China story from what's happening elsewhere in the globe. And we are currently facing a number of economic and political uncertainties, from obviously the US-China trade war to Brexit and the more general weakening of the EU as an economic bloc, the sort of broader transition among economies from manufacturing to services and consumption, the energy system shifting from natural resources to renewable technologies. So all of these factors are converging, and what we're seeing is a synchronized slowdown across the globe. So the IMF is, in its latest World Economic Outlook, predicts that 90% of the world's economy will experience slower growth in 2019. And this isn't something that's a complete shock when we look at the sort of cyclical boom and bust of the economy and 10 years of growth since the last financial crisis. We can expect some kind of slower growth, if not recession, in the years ahead. So what are the signs of a recession across the globe? Well, global growth is at its lowest since the last financial crisis in 2008. And the most recent quarterly data shows that Britain and Germany have only narrowly avoided entering a technical recession, two quarters of negative growth just this month. The US manufacturing sector is in decline, and global trade overall has slowed. And as we've heard, obviously China's growth is at its lowest point since 1992 in terms of its annual GDP. And if we kind of look at the context prior to the last financial crisis, in 2007, China was growing at an annual rate of 15%. So it's quite a big difference, down to 6.2% this year. So when we look at the uncertain times, the US-China trade war has to be one of the major factors that is hurting the global economy, not just the US and China. And one of the major reasons this goes beyond tariffs is around impacting consumer and investor confidence. The IMF predicts, which I think James alluded to before, that the cumulative effect of trade conflicts could potentially equal a loss of about $700 billion into 2020. And to put this into perspective, that's the size of Switzerland's entire economy. So it's certainly doing some harm across the globe. But it's also hurting US consumers more than it's hurting or more than it's actually impacting China's slower growth, because a lot of the tariffs on Chinese goods coming to the US are actually being passed on to the consumer. And as we've heard, China's economic struggles and slower growth began before the US-China trade troubles due to a number of internal factors, inefficient SOEs, a lack of opening up to the private sector and private central banks, loans for private companies. Obviously, the list goes on, as we've heard. So the US-China trade war is sort of an overlaying umbrella of uncertainty on top of all of those internal struggles that we've already been seeing. So the consumer confidence is something that's particularly concerning for China, which really does need that consumption element to stimulate and drive economic growth. It also poses a risk to the global economy, as 40% of China's $13 trillion GDP is made up of household spending. And over the past 10 years, Chinese consumers have accounted for 1/7 of the world's global growth. So certainly a very important element for us to consider. So what are the policy levers that governments can employ to address the slowing of growth or to try and mitigate entering a recession? Well, each recession is different, so the policy levers in response will also differ in terms of what's available and what will be effective. And we've already seen China taking action, trying to restructure its internal problems, and this year announcing a number of measures trying to stimulate that growth. So they've cut the amount of cash that banks must hold on reserve to try and increase liquidity across the market, as well as increasing the number of loans for small to medium enterprises. But China's certainly cautious about deploying any kind of major stimulus measures after the sort of big packages it put up in 2008 to pull itself out of the financial crisis and the levels of debt that have been accumulating since then, as we've heard about. Premier Li has said that he's ruled those kind of measures out because he didn't say this openly, but one of the reasons you would assume is to avoid ramping up further debt. In terms of other levers that we might see, we've actually got the Central Economic Work Conference in the next couple of weeks, so all of the Chinese Communist Party key leaders will come together and basically set their economic agenda for 2020. And some of the things that we might see during that conference include local bonds to stimulate infrastructure projects, implementation of tax cuts that we've already seen announced across the year, and, of course, an ideal one that we may or may not see is the de-escalation of trade tensions with the US. So there's a deadline looming this Sunday for new tariffs being imposed on Chinese goods coming to the US, particularly on toys, laptops, phones and clothes, which is just in time for Christmas, sadly for the American consumer. But hopefully, with the ongoing negotiations, this might be delayed or amended. So we'll hopefully find out more in the coming days. But as James mentioned, it's not all doom and gloom, and there are some positives that we can point to. So Asia remains the fastest growing region in the world, and it still comprised more than 2/3 of global growth this year, according to the IMF. China alone, according to the same data, accounted for 39% of global growth this year, followed by India at 16% and the ASEAN region at 10%. And despite the dent in Chinese or consumer confidence more broadly and in China and the US, Chinese consumption has managed to remain robust overall, which is a really positive sign. And as James mentioned, we've heard that the number of Chinese consumers continues to grow, with the middle class rising. There are a number of different estimates, with McKinsey's latest prediction saying that in the next 3 years, the middle class should hit about 550 million. So, and though the economy, we're seeing this slower growth, which I think Professor Deng said that we could be expecting, the economy itself is actually worth more than what it was prior to the last financial crisis. its GDP has doubled in size since 2007, from 3.5 trillion up to 13.5 trillion this year. And we could never expect the sort of double-digit growth that we were seeing in the sort of mid-2000s to be sustainable. So what we're seeing now is it might be slowing kind of faster than expected, but slower growth is what you should predict when you're transitioning to a more sustainable economy. And that's my view on the situation.
Great. Thank you, Dara. I'm going to start by offering a few questions, reactions to our panelists and to hear their thoughts, and then we'll ask some questions for the audience. I'm going to first start by giving what I think is a overview of the West. I would include not just the U.S., but parts of Europe and elsewhere, concerns about China, and then I'd like to see whether or not you could give me your sense of the reactions to this. So the list is long, beginning with things like restricted and discriminatory access to Chinese markets, allegations of forced technology transfers, complaints about cyber theft and cybersecurity, excessive subsidization of state-owned enterprises, aggressive and destabilizing behavior in the near, in China's near abroad and elsewhere, the slashing of rights and liberties in Hong Kong and other places in China, the construction of what some would call the greatest surveillance state ever built in the history of mankind, humankind. Many of these things are central to China's growth model. And James mentioned some of these in his, Hannah and his, her remarks as well. And yet lots of these also contribute not only to rising uncertainty, thus damaging potentially China's economic performance, but also more significantly, undermine the vibrancy and the resiliency and the ability of the private sector to expand. So we know, for instance, that the private sector in China is the most efficient part of the economy relative to the public sector or state sector. It has the greatest amounts to value-added GDP, and yet the state enterprises get the lion's share of the resources and continue to do so, particularly over the period of this extended buildup of debt. So all of these things I'd like to think have you sort of react to in terms of how do these things or which of these things do you think we most likely to see movement on, given the challenges that it poses to the regime's political survival and its model of economic growth.
This is a question for all of us.
I hope so.
That's a tough one. Yeah. Should go ahead.
Well, or maybe I could start with Hong Kong. Which I think is going to be a real test of how we understand Chinese politics. The crisis there, in the Communist Party's language, has involved challenges not only on a local level, but also systemic ones. In other words, by talking about a color revolution, a cabal of black hands involving foreign powers trying to destabilize Hong Kong and thereby destabilize the rest of China, by talking about bottom lines having been crossed by the protesters in Hong Kong, the leadership in Beijing has created a rhetoric that suggests this is much, much more than simply a local problem. This is a problem for the Communist Party's legitimacy. It's a challenge to Xi Jinping's authority. Now, how has the central government in the past responded to challenges of such a dramatic nature? Well, there have been very few examples in the reform era which have escalated to this kind of level in terms of the way that the party itself is conceptualizing the nature of this problem. One obvious one occurred in 1989. And then we saw how it created such a degree of tension in the leadership, such tension predated the unrest on the streets, of course, as I described earlier. But then a synergy grew between the unrest on the streets and what was going on at an elite level, and ultimately resulted in a decision which was, one can only assume, extremely difficult for the leadership to make, given what it thought it might lose. The history of the 1980s being one of opening up to the West, of forming a strategic alliance with the United States, one during which Deng Xiaoping had held out the prospect in the very, very long term, by the middle of the 21st century, perhaps, of some degree of convergence between Hong Kong and the rest of the mainland in terms of the way their systems work. And that would not mean Hong Kong being mainlandized. It would mean the mainland becoming more like Hong Kong. But such was the nature of the threat that was perceived that a dramatic decision was made, not only to terminate the unrest in Beijing, but to do so with extreme force that would have consequences across the entire spectrum of China's behavior, from its international relations, its newly forged relationship with the West, to the economy, which Deng Xiaoping had invested a great deal of political capital in steering away from Maoism. And he knew, surely, that what happened in 89 would give succor to the kind of remnant Maoists in the system who were still arguing throughout the 1980s that market forces were to be resisted, that the Communist Party's survival depended on retaining many of the elements of the Maoist economy. So he was taking a dramatic risk with his own restructuring of China internally as well. And yet the decision was made, and perhaps curiously so, given how the protests had appeared to be winding down by June the 4th. But for whatever reason, that was the decision made. So, fast forwarding, we've seen other crises of a lesser nature, but also in the party's view, extremely threatening. One of those occurred during the build-up to Xi Jinping's taking of power in 2012. That resulted in a sweeping purge at the very highest levels of the leadership, a potentially destabilizing one, a hugely risky one, that involved not only all the characters I just mentioned, but dozens of high-level military officials. We hadn't seen such a shake-up at the very top levels of the party leadership for many, many years in China. It was a risky move, but it was one that was motivated by a sense of existential threat. And here we are again. I think it's a bit too early to say that all is well, because the party hasn't yet sent in troops or taken more dramatic measures to control what's going on there. It's playing out more slowly, perhaps, than previous crises. But I think the central leadership is well aware that the world is watching, that a huge amount is at stake, and what's at stake is not just China's global reputation, but also, of course, its economic interests. which Hong Kong plays a critical role in. And those interests are also of many members of the elite who have big stakes in Hong Kong's economy. But at the end of the day, how will Xi Jinping respond to a threat that he has characterized as one that is threatening to the party's very grip on power? Will he take the more pragmatic approach of just letting Hong Kong sort it out for itself? Will he lose patience? If he is facing a lot of internal challenges as a result of the China-US trade war, the economy, anti-corruption campaign, all those other things, if there are indeed powerful forces within the very highest levels of the leadership that that are lined up against him, will they be taking advantage of the turmoil in Hong Kong to put pressure on him, leading perhaps to a response that might be much more interventionist, just to prove his authority? All of these, I think, are very open questions and extremely critical ones right now. Sadly, we don't know the answers to them. I think, you know, we have to be totally honest and say that this is a moment when we need to know who Xi Jinping is, and we really don't. We can only hope that the way things have transpired since June, in other words, the central government generally, keeping its forces out, even though it's had a very big role in terms of the way things have played out day to day in terms of Carrie Lam's responses. But at least that's better than huge bloodshed on the streets. And we can only hope that Xi Jinping is pragmatic enough and sensible enough not to step things up further.
I'll just throw out two additional remarks to the panelists, and then you can sort of pick and choose what you want to discuss. So a common thread across a couple of the panelists was this idea of inequality being a problem for China. One interpretation of the Hong Kong developments is one in which Hong Kongese are reacting not only to political repression and a crackdown of rights and liberties in Hong Kong, but they're reacting to declining prospects for intergenerational mobility, that young people in Hong Kong no longer see themselves enjoying the same prospects to own a home, to advance in society in the same way that their elders did. This is tied directly to developments in China, right? Rising inequality across the country as a whole, but also inequality that is distributed unequally geographically and across ethnic groups, right? So we know that certain people in the South are doing better off than people in the North and the Center, and that many of the gains from economic development have been concentrated largely amongst the ethnically Han Chinese as opposed to elsewhere. So I was wondering if, hoping that some of the panelists could discuss that. The other thing I was hoping to throw out there was something that hasn't been discussed but is on the minds of many of us, which is climate change. So climate change features critically in much of what China's trying to do and has made great strides to do this until, unfortunately, recently. We see that China, I would say regrettably, has decided to step up the use of coal and coal plants production. At the same time, like other countries, it's failed to meet its emission targets, despite claiming that it's doing its best to do so. This creates another tension for China, which is not only how you deal with debts, inequality, but how do you manage responsibility for climate change globally at a time where you know that the rest of us are trying to deal with it, and the cost associated with that will lead to potentially slow down in economic growth, but also severe distributional consequences for those individuals that find themselves in these areas of the economy. So I just throw out these two things on inequality and climate change.
Perhaps I can take inequalities again. China's inequality has been institutionalized because of the dual-track system. The leadership currently, as James mentioned, supports the state ownership and state sector. And this is where the problem starts. So easy money, cheap loans can be obtained by the state sector, and then they actually create the secondary markets for run seeking. So this is where the problem starts. So although the government supports the state sector, but there's a sort of a negative externalities related to the government support. It's all, you know, well designed, well sort of wished, but they didn't realize cheap loans and cheap resources for the state sector, which doesn't produce a result. Terribly inefficient. Apparently, opens the doors for rent seeking, and this really is the whole story of China's problem of inequality, and the government decision to strengthen the state sector at the expense of the private sector as the state policy really in a way make the situation even worse, simply because if you are the manager of the state enterprise, you have the entitlement to have very cheap loans. Then, I mean, from the Xi Jinping's leadership's point of view, anti or counter corruption drive or campaign will remove the bad potatoes, and therefore this is really will address the issue of inequality. But remember, if you put those leaders and managers in jail, you only deal with the result of corruption. You are not address the causes of it. Therefore, this you can never actually eliminate within the party and also within the state sector the degree of corruption. The degree of corruption doesn't really decrease over time. What surprises us is this. Although over 2 million officials were locked up, stripped of their assets and their bank accounts, you have potentially another 2 million waiting for their chances to perform rent-seeking, simply because the entitlement of very cheap resource, very cheap loans, easy money, waiting for them to actually tap in. So the problem of giving the state sector, which is the source of corruption, the source of inequality, the source of inefficiency, really is self-defeating. Because if you think socialism, communism depends on that sector, that's a wrong sector. Or China.
Yeah, on the climate change front, as we know, China is the world's largest carbon emitter, and it's currently building about 50% more coal-fired power plants than the total world combined. So it's pretty scary stuff in terms of, China saying they're on track to meet the Paris commitments, and then we see that recently they've sort of gone into a backward slide on progress. But they do remain the largest market for investment in renewable energies. And I think we're going to see continued pressure from global companies that are trying to reduce their carbon footprint across the supply chain for renewable sources in China in terms of how those products are manufactured. And it's not just a matter of ethical sustainability or sustainable ethics, it's about cost as well. So manufacturing is already moving, to places like Vietnam where labor is cheaper. If it turns out that China hasn't transitioned quickly enough as the cost of renewables continues to plummet, that'll be another increasing pressure point on China. But I think the biggest problem here is that China's really, you know, increased its geopolitical soft power, but we're facing a global leadership gap when it comes to climate change. And, you know, the US, there's no point looking there. You know, I think the UK's got its sort of hands tied up, and to some extent so does the EU. So we're not really seeing anyone take a strong stand in this area, which is exactly what we need. We need global cooperation, but we're really seeing industries driving change. So hopefully that ongoing pressure from industry will have some impact in China.
Yeah, thanks. And one of the things we might see increasingly as well is the growing discussion we have been seeing of the use of green tariffs, that essentially countries that are doing more to reduce emissions may see themselves opting for the use of protectionist policies, not for reasons associated with what we've been talking about so far, but to penalize those countries that are failing to achieve these targets. It's now the time when we'd love to hear from our audience. So we have a microphone? We do, yeah. So there's at least two questions in the back. Yeah.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much, first of all, for your information. 9 years ago at Imperial Business School in London, I attend lecture about China, and the main question is when the Chinese culture will be transferred as Western culture. This 9 years ago. And now I think it's time to re-ask this question again after we see what's happened from Mr. Trump war and what's happened now in Hong Kong. So the question for Professor Kent, do you think now or in the future the Chinese culture will be Western culture? And the other question for Professor Jeff or Mr. James, how is it important for West to see China transferring to Western culture?
Sorry, I couldn't make out.
How it's important. And we see it's one of the main goal of foreign direct investment to see transformation from inside Asia culture to very close, we say, to Western culture. So we start the world trade now and see what's happening in Hong Kong, and still foreign direct investment didn't achieve that goal. So how it is important for West to see Chinese culture transferred, as we say, Western culture, or very close at least, in very close level. This question, it was in Imperial College 9 years ago. If you back anyone into the archive, you can find it. So when I hear what's going now in Hong Kong and Mr. Trump, I think it's time to re-ask this question again. Thank you very much.
I can answer it briefly. That raises huge questions about what is the nature of Chinese culture, what is Western culture. Are the universal values that are commonly spoken of as features of Western cultures also ones that are part of Chinese culture? And that's a debate that's been going on in China for a very long time. It has its origins in the 19th century and has raged on since then. I think, encouraging feature of such debate since the reform and opening period began has been the degree to which many Chinese see this not in binary terms, but as a universal issue, and the whole debate around universal values, in spite of the ebbs and flows of Chinese politics over the past four decades, has continued, and indeed we've seen signs within the leadership itself that from time to time that there is a degree of acceptance that the values that we cherish here are also ones that Chinese people aspire to. Has it been the aim of a Western investment in China ultimately to bring about some degree of cultural change? I don't think so at all. I think there's been a hope throughout, a hope that this system will be one that accepts global norms, the norms that are signed up to by all countries that are members of the United Nations in terms of human rights and other values. But it hasn't been the strategy, I think, of any country, including the United States, to use investment as a means of bringing about a political change. Certainly many had hoped that accession to the WTO, for example, in 2001 would bring about liberalization, but nobody was predicting that it would happen in the next few years. Certainly since 2012, anyone who had been hoping that it would happen soon has been feeling rather frustrated.
Well, for me, it's very difficult to define what is Chinese culture, the term. If you look mainland China, the political culture at the moment has been introduced from Russia, Soviet Union. The whole political system, ideology, the administration, the structure, has been on a wholesale fashion introduced by Stalin. So will that be part of Chinese culture now? The mainlanders say yes. Yeah, well, if you talk about Chinese, certain Chinese characteristics of their behavior, then you see Taiwanese are far more traditional than mainlanders, because they didn't have the, upheavals of Cultural Revolution. So they have more, Chinese unique culture preserved in Taiwan. I was very shocked when I traveled between Taipei and Kaohsiung. And older Taiwan travelers gave their seats to a group of college students simply because they actually have a badge of normal universities. So because these group of youngsters are considered future teachers, so regardless of ages, elderly, whoever on the train will give them their seats. This is really Confucianism. You can't imagine on mainland trains, people will give seats, older people give seats to young university students simply because they will be future teachers. So in that sense, I don't think you have a well-defined or possibility to define Chinese culture, especially in mainland China. Xi Jinping talks about human commonalities, 人类命运共同体, which for me is either Chinese or European. So we don't know. We don't even know how to understand this human commonality.
According to the consideration, I'm adept the Western economy system for years now, over 30 years. How does that may affect in terms of society?
Yeah,
I'm just in the last 50 years, I'm a European. I've been to China many times. I see the old generation far away.
Well, in terms of business practices, certainly the Chinese are very westernized now. They speak, you know, if you talk to younger generations of Chinese, they speak fluent, you know, English. So in that sense, they are halfway becoming something else, yeah.
So there's several hands. Maybe you could collect a question from that gentleman, and then the person in front, that one, and then this student over here, this person over here on the left. Maybe collect two questions.
Hi there. I'll try and keep it brief. Adam McRae, so former student of Ken. But this is a question to everyone on the stage. What if you had to have an elevator pitch to both the leaders of the U.S. and China, to how would you advise them on avoiding a future possible society, I can never say it, but the Sidious trap? If you caught either of them in an elevator, what would you try and tell them?
Hi, yes, my question isn't so brief, but I know that it can be limited. With the growing, or rather weakening position of the EU bloc, and maybe Brexit and eventual maybe disintegration of the EU in the coming years, what is China's role in Europe in going into the future, especially in terms of their involvement in Africa and in Central Asia?
On the last one, China's currently negotiating quite protracted negotiations with a free trade agreement with the EU. So if Britain was to remain in the EU, Britain would be a beneficiary of that. In terms of Brexit, we would hope to see a Britain and China FTA. I guess Britain's position would be somewhat weakened by kind of having broken away from the EU. In terms of China's FDI into Africa, I think there is sort of a deliberate strategy behind that in terms of building soft power through that investment across that region. So I think it's something that the EU should, and I'm sure is aware of, but I think China has a lot of capital to sort of give away, and Africa needs it, and that's also supporting a problem in terms of some of the migration issues into the EU. So, bearing in mind some of the potential political risks, particularly around that building that kind of geopolitical influence, I think that we'll continue to see a growth in that investment into Africa.
Well, for me, if I came across, which is a very slim chance, on elevator with either Xi Jinping or Trump, I would say compromise. So,
on the elevator one, I would say to Mr. Xi, I would say to use the phrase that James used, which would be beware of gray rhinos. Essentially, don't become complacent about things in China that you see everywhere that don't necessarily seem risky but can suddenly blow up. And to Mr. Trump or his successors, I would say beware of friends who bear in gifts. Don't settle for a deal with somebody when there's a whole range of concerns out there. So don't accept things, concessions on buying more soya beans or something to that effect, when there are larger issues at stake that many in the West, not just the United States, are concerned about in terms of what China's behavior is doing in the global stage. So that would be my advice to both of them.
Also on the European side of the story, China is quite aggressively pushing for One Belt, One Road right through the heartland of Europe. We must actually say this. The One Belt, One Road project is actually for the United Nations, not for any one country. I don't think China is capable of running it, period.
Can we try to take three more questions, maybe? From this side of the room, there's hand there, and then in the front, maybe? Make you work for it, I guess.
Thank you. So I have one question for Mr. Miles. So you mentioned that the nationalism may become the source of legitimacy for the party. Mm. So my question is that how would the party sustain the nationalism in the future, in your opinion? Thank you.
How do the party what?
How would the party sustain the nationalism in the future? Yeah.
So my question is more about economy. So if we're talking about net zero and Chinese desire to, by 2050, become more like net zero economy, literally. And you said that we will accept no growth in such in this sustainable economy concept. So if the UK goes to net zero by 2050, China goes to net zero by 2050, is the no growth now is okay? Because generally, like I do know because that's my subject, that climate change happens much faster and we need to take action now. And no government, no market will not accept no growth. And what is the, like, how we can maintain, I don't know, some growth in this position? I don't know, just something vague. But
one more in the front, if you can.
Thank you very much for coming today. I'm Riley. I'm a student here at the LSE in International Affairs program. I had a question for Professor Deng. You spoke about China's internal problems and touched on the debt issue. I know with One Belt, One Road, a lot of the China's exporting its construction capacity out to, you know, developing countries. And to me, what this means is that large state-run enterprises addled with debt are able to shift the burden of that debt up to developing countries. I know China Railway Corporation itself has an astronomical amount of debt. And I was wondering how exposed the Chinese economy is to the risk of default by the countries funding these projects, and also exposed to the risk of a decrease of Chinese investment in One Belt, One Road projects. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll answer that question about nationalism. I'm glad you raised that, because I think it is it's a critical question, really. Because what we might expect as a result of the party's efforts to bolster nationalism at home is not only a continuation of the more assertive foreign policy that we've seen develop over the past the past decade, but accelerate over the past 7 years or so, but something perhaps even beyond that, which is more threatening, more dangerous to the established order in the Western Pacific, that might involve confrontation with other countries in the region, around the perimeter of China, from Japan through to Taiwan, and of course the United States in the South China Sea or other spheres where China has interests, Vietnam, India. But I think that there's another factor tugging at Xi Jinping or China's leadership when it comes to nationalism, and that is concern about the effect of letting it run away. And I think one very striking feature of Xi Jinping's leadership is that we haven't seen anti-Japanese unrest on the streets. We haven't seen anti-American protests on the streets since 2012. We did in 1999, following the Belgrade bombing. We saw anti-American unrest then. We saw anti-Japanese protests. We've seen those repeatedly, but most conspicuously, perhaps, in the build-up to Xi Jinping's accession in 2012, in the summer of that year, but not since then. Why? Because I think it also carries a strong element of risk, and letting people vent their frustrations on the streets is seen by the party as a very risky strategy. So I think we're going to see more of an attempt to portray the party as the true defender of China's national interests, more beefing up of China's military capability and showing off of that, not by attacking other countries, but through the kind of big parade that we just had on October the 1st. There will always be that tension between a desire to bolster the party's reputation as the as the, you know, the rightful a political force in China, with the duty and the ability to defend the country's national interests on the one hand, and a fear on the other hand of how nationalist unrest can develop. And don't forget what happened in 1989 was described at the time as the patriotic demonstration, patriotic democratic protests. I mean, those were the two terms that the students themselves used, and the word patriotic came first.
Right. Only that issue. Remember, in this country, we have RBS, a accumulated huge amount of debts. And yet, with the government support, they start to continue their business. So they carry their debts, plus they make loans. And this is quite similar to the railway constructing companies in China. On the one hand, domestically, they produce more than enough iron, steel, and the rail tracks. So from the Chinese leadership point of view, they are too big to fail. They are too political to fail. They are state-owned businesses. So they can't lay out their workers simply because this is part of the stability scheme. So you keep your workers fed, and everything will be fine. So now we know, for example, China produce altogether more iron and steel than G7 countries put together. And China really doesn't need that much steel. So One Belt, One Road is one way to actually export China's surplus capacity out of the Chinese territories. Now, of course, they have a lot of domestic debts, but they hope that with the export of China's new railways and also with the government cheap credit, they can swap the credit with the debt, plus the new business may actually allow them to absorb some of the bad debts. So that means, for them, this new Belt and Road project is their lifeline now, not domestically, but externally. Yeah, we will see what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I understood your question, but if it's about sort of the reconciling economic growth with carbon reduction, I think it's one of the toughest, questions that is facing all global leaders at the moment. So I think I'm unlikely to, answer with anything novel that gives you any kind of hope on that front. But I think that, you know, we clearly need to transition the energy system much more rapidly, develop carbon capture technologies much more quickly as well, and basically review the entire kind of production and consumption growth model that underpins capitalism. So they're pretty fundamental questions that I think we're all grappling with at the moment. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for you than that.
Yeah, so, well, it's not that we don't have an answer. It's just, you know, so it's not can we do it, it's when can we do it, right? So for us, I think the trick is not can you have sustainable growth and net zero, it's how do you transition to that? And this is the debate that is increasingly being had in the West about, you know, do you go for a Green New Deal? Do you use carbon dividends and so on? China will have to follow suit in that, right? It will have to figure out some way to manage the transition cost of moving individuals, which there are a lot, out of these more carbon-intensive industries into new industries, greener technologies, and so on, and managing that capacity while maintaining, or I should say, while minimizing the political threat that that poses, to use James's language, is the one of the big tricks that we'll have to pull off. With that, I'm going to pull things to a close. I want to thank all three of my panelists, Kent, James, and Hannah, for joining us, and for you for joining us in the audience. Thank you very much for your attention this evening.